This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder and executive editor of Yes Magazine and yesmagazine.org. Sarah is a frequent guest on radio and television, commenting on current affairs. Sarah Van Gelder is here today to tell us about the book she edited, titled This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement. She will also discuss the 15th anniversary issue of Yes Magazine, featuring 15 extraordinary people transforming the way we live. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Diane. Glad to be here.
How did the book This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement come about?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when the occupations first began, we were very excited about it at Yes, and we began covering the occupation in New York online via a number of different people who were there and who were commenting on what was happening. And we felt like it was such an important breakthrough because it was so well pinpointing the cause of so many of our issues, and we can get into that more later. So we were covering it quite actively, and a book publisher from Barrett Kohler, Steve Piersante, noticed that we were doing some really good substantive coverage and asked us if we'd be willing to quickly pull together some of that coverage and some other pieces and create what he calls an instant book. So that's what we did. Once we decided to do it, we had about 10 days to pull together the articles we'd already published. We found some blogs written by some of the key organizers from Zuccotti Park, worked with them on adapting those to make them ready for the book. I did an original introduction to it. We pulled it all together and we went to press in 10 days, and then it was off the presses in a week.
Who contributed to the book? Would you say more about that?
Sure. Some of the people are people who are, again, deeply enmeshed in the original organizing of the occupation and on Wall Street. It's interesting. They include people you might not have ever heard of because there are people who've been doing a lot of grassroots organizing, but they're not necessarily famous people. So one of them is Marina Citrin, and she wrote a book on horizontalism coming out of the experience in Argentina when their economy collapsed and people went to the streets and then eventually took over occupied a lot of the factories that owners had abandoned and turned them into worker cooperatives. So she's written a lot about that, but she's also been very much of an activist in New York City on doing horizontalism, you know, on the streets, doing citizen-based, non-hierarchical activism in New York. So she's one of the key people who did that. And she wrote a piece. She'd been blogging as this occupation unfolded, and we worked with her on adapting her blog to be part of this book. There's a couple of other people, David Graeber, who's quite well known. He facilitated the first General Assembly that took place prior to the occupation and was what sort of set the groundwork for all the working teams it would take to actually pull off the occupation. And a woman named Hannah Ashraf, who is a Muslim woman of South Asian descent, and we worked with her on adapting her blog about what it was like as a woman of color to come into this situation, to feel that there were some issues in the declaration that the Wall Street activists were pulling together, some issues that really did not well acknowledge the experience of people of color, and how she went about both educating people and feeling some dismay that those issues were ones that she felt like she had to educate people about, but then also this feeling of elation that she had when she realized that she actually could make a difference. So those are some of the perspectives from the inside of the movement. And then we also have some of the, I think, more astute observers, people like Naomi Klein, whose piece we included, The Most Important Thing in the World, is actually based on a speech she gave at Zuccotti Park, a piece by David Corton, who has been recognized by a number of people as one of the people who has been clearly pointing out the issues of why Wall Street is causing so much damage and how we need to move more to a Main Street economy. We have a piece by Ralph Nader on people power, a wonderful article by Rebecca Solnit that acknowledges the role of the Tunisian activists going all the way back to the beginning of the Arab Spring and how that unfolded into the European and then the U.S. uprisings.
What are the key ways that the Occupy Wall Street movement has changed everything?
Well, we actually listed 10 of them. I could mention a few of them. I think one of the most important things it did is it named the source of the crisis. I think there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, why are we in such trouble right now? And the clarity of this naming of the Wall Street power and wealth system and the way in which 1% have claimed the wealth and the resources and the political power and left the 99% out. Those two things resonate just very, very, very profoundly with people all across the country. And so I think that's one of the reasons why everywhere you look, you can find an Occupy springing up, an uprising, because people understand that that is true. And once they feel like, okay, now I can finally be part of something that actually goes to the root of the problem, I think it's very empowering and very important for people. And I think it's also really getting the attention of the political insiders, because they may have thought they could get away with this cozy relationship between the ultra-rich and, you know, the powerful in Washington, D.C., but I think they're now starting to realize that the rest of the 99% really are not going to stand for that. So naming the source of the crisis, I think, is one of the absolutely essential items that this movement has brought to the fore. And I think another thing that's been really important is the way in which the Occupy sites themselves have been so insistent on some very basic principles of democracy, of inclusion, non-hierarchical. You know, it's been called leaderless, but what it really amounts to is that everyone has an opportunity to be a leader and to be acknowledged and to have their voices heard. And I think that there is a way in which the movement is actually experimenting with the kind of world we want to create. It's not just coming up with a list of demands. You know, we keep hearing from people more accustomed to the established route for political discourse. They would like a set of demands that then could be debated in the old style. And I think the occupations have been just so smart about saying, no, we're actually going to have a deeper conversation about the kind of world we want to create. And not only that, we're going to experiment with creating it right here where we are right now. And we're going to decide how we want to live. And essentially, this hasn't been quite so explicit, but essentially the power structure can come to us because we're the 99%. And we need to have a world that works for all of us in the 99%. So those are a couple of things. We could go on with that. There's a number more. We have on our website, yesmagazine.org, we actually listed 10 ways in which the Occupy movement changes everything.
Why don't you discuss a couple more?
Okay. I think one of the really fascinating thing is in terms of the inclusiveness is how you see people from so many different walks of life. You see a lot of young people. I think young people are actually at the core of this movement. Young people who've graduated from college or not, but can't find work. And many of them are deeply in debt because it costs so much to get through college now. So essentially, they're playing by the rules. And yet, when they come to the point where they need to find work that can enable them to pay off their debt, it simply isn't there. So you find people ranging from young college students, you find veterans from the military, you find people of all ages who are unemployed or who are simply fed up. You find homeless people, too. A lot of these occupation sites are feeding anyone who comes and providing a safe space. And so homeless people are gravitating there as well. So one of the things that's happening that's so fascinating is that people are sitting down and talking with folks they might not otherwise talk to. Our society has become so siloed, you know, people who stay within their own philosophical group or their own class group or their own ethnic group. The Occupy sites have been a place where people are coming together and crossing those lines. And so you see a middle-class kid who may never have sat down before with a homeless person, and they're talking about the kind of world that they want to create together. So I think crossing those lines and coming to understand each other better, I think, is one of the really important things that's going on.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor of Yes Magazine and editor of the book, This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What strikes you most about the Occupy groups that you have visited personally?
Well, I think the thing that strikes me most is that there seems to be almost a joy permeating the atmosphere, even though there are lots of hardships and challenges. But there's almost a sense of, oh, this is what I've been waiting for. I didn't realize we could live this way, that we could really take care of each other. I remember the first day I went to Zuccotti Park, and I'm just observing, you know, a general assembly, and somebody walks up with a box of pizza, and they're just handing out pizza to anybody who's hungry. And it was sort of startling to be in New York where everything has got a price on it and everybody's a little suspicious of one another, and for somebody to just be handing out food like that. So I think there's just a sense of almost like coming home. You know, here's a place where my voice matters, where it doesn't matter how much money I have or don't have. It doesn't matter whether my life is not playing out as I had hoped it would. I am a human being, and therefore I'm respected.
Well, you've alluded a bit to this, but what do you think is most drawing people to the movement?
When you think about the 99%, that's such a broad group of people. I don't think there's any one thing. But I talked to one person who is unemployed, you know, and he spends part of his day looking for work. But then rather than being isolated at home, he comes to the occupation site every day and works there, and his contribution is valued and needed, and he can feel like he's part of something instead of feeling like he's been rejected by a society that really only works well for the 1%. So there's people who are there for that. There are people who are there because there's a good meal to be had. There are people there who've been activists all their lives looking for the best way to create a more sustainable or a more just society and find the occupation movement to be the most promising. I think there are people who are there because they're tired of holding up a sign and just wishing the power structure would pay attention to them. They're tired of being ignored. And one of the remarkable things about the Occupy movement is that it's not in that protest mode. It's in a very different mode in terms of simply saying, we will create a different world. We're not asking the power structure to make this or that modification. We will create a different world. And I think that's very empowering after many, many years of feeling like, you know, we're on the margins while the powerful make all the decisions, to feel like, no, instead we are the sovereign people of this country and we can make these choices.
Would you say more about the ways the Occupy movement is modeling democracy?
Sure. One of the features that is most noticeable and remarkably spread, you know, across the country to all the different Occupy sites, as far as I know, is the General Assembly. And the General Assembly includes whoever comes. It has some practices that have been posted online that derive from the Spanish experience, the M15 movement in Spain. But basically what it involves is that anyone who has a proposal, there's a process by which they can bring their proposal to the group. Decisions are made by consensus or by a modified form of consensus. People bring up proposals. There's often small group discussions of how different folks feel about those proposals. There's what they call temperature checks, where everyone is given an opportunity to give an indication of how they're feeling about an idea. And you've probably seen the twinkly fingers, where people put their fingers up in the air and wave them, and that's a general indication of support, or they put them down, which is a general indication of not support. And then there's a process for blocking consensus. If someone feels so deeply opposed to something, they're able to block consensus. And some sites have created ways in which the process can still go forward if there's just a few of those people, and some have not. Some of them actually, you know, every single person has to agree. So it's asking each person who's there to personally take responsibility for the well-being of the whole. That example I gave you earlier about Hannah Ashraf, her concerns about the language that she felt was insensitive to people of color, she was able to bring that to the attention of the whole General Assembly by blocking consensus on the language they planned to use. And then a group of people formed around her to struggle through the kind of process of figuring out what language would be appropriate and would appropriately take into account her concerns. And they did do that. And then that was the language that was adopted eventually. So it can take longer, but in the end, you don't have a minority that walks off feeling excluded. You have every voice being thoroughly heard.
Would you say more about the community building aspects of the Occupy movement?
Well, again, instead of being a protest where you show up and, you know, you hold up your sign and then you go home, the Occupy movement has actually been setting up these small tent villages. And what that means is that there's a lot of work to be done to manage the day-to-day necessities of life. Where is food going to come from? How can medical care be provided to people who might need it? Because they're in confrontations with the police, there's often legal help that's required. There's comfort, you know, in Ducati Park anyway, there was a comfort team that was doing what it could to help keep people warm and to provide the little extras that make life work well. There's communications and media. So there's lots of different places where help is needed, and these working teams include people who volunteer to be part of them. So I think that kind of involvement, when people are stepping up and volunteering and doing what they can, that creates a setting in which each person can see that their contribution is important and also that other people will take care of them. And that kind of gift-giving, that giving and receiving, that's what weaves together a community and weaves together relationships and creates that sense of commitment that we so often lose in a society where everything we need we pay for and everything that we offer we expect to be paid for.
In one section of your book, you address what needs to change in our society. Would you like to give a few highlights of what needs to change to benefit the 99%?
Sure. One caveat there is that the Occupy movement has not created a list of demands, and they've been very clear that, you know, that any demands are really things that individuals may be bringing to the fore in the form of the signs that they carry at demonstrations. But you do see themes that come up over and over again. One of them has to do with inequality, and that's the basic slogan of the 1% capturing the wealth and power of our society while the 99% are being left behind. We have an article that's part of an interview that Brooke Jarvis, our web editor, did with Richard Wilkinson, who wrote a book called The Spirit Level. And the book is quite remarkable in that it really describes the many, many ways that inequality poisons our society. It's not just the people at the bottom who suffer. The society suffers from top to bottom. And this interview with Rich Wilkinson brings out some of the key places where that shows up. The second is on the tax system. Chuck Collins, who is actually heir to a rather large fortune himself, has been an advocate for a much more just tax system in which the wealthiest Americans pay their share. And he has an article in this piece about three places to start to get that tax system to work far more justly. And by the way, that's one of the interesting places where this movement does represent so well the majority of Americans, because it's a large majority of Americans who believe that the super wealthy ought to be paying more taxes. And yet we haven't been able to get that through Congress so far, because Congress seems to be very enmeshed with the interests of the 1%. Certainly the Republican Party seems to put that as the bottom line, that they will do absolutely nothing that involves reducing the ability of the 1% to further increase their wealth. But the American people, by large majorities, including majorities of Republicans, do believe that that's fair for the very wealthy to pay more taxes. So this article is about three specific ways that could happen next. And we have a piece by David Corton in that section about how Main Street can be liberated from Wall Street, and it looks at our money and banking system and how both are now institutions that systematically redistribute money from ordinary people to the very wealthy, and what it would look like if we had the opposite, if we had a money and banking system that supported the real economy, that provides real goods and services and real jobs to ordinary people, instead of a money and banking system that funnels all of those resources up to the top to Wall Street institutions and the super wealthy executives who run them.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor of Yes Magazine and editor of the book This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement. Would you share your ideas about how to support the Occupy movement?
Sure. Oh, there's so many ways to do that. You know, and I think at first some people thought the only way that you could be supportive was to sleep outside, and not everyone feels comfortable doing that. And although that is, I think, a really important, really core part of the process is to be in an Occupy site, you know, some people are managing that by just coming during the day, but they go home at night to sleep. Some people are having other kinds of ways of supporting the folks that are occupying by bringing them food, bringing comfort like blankets and tents and supplies to Occupy sites, and a great many of them will actually have their own website or Facebook page where they list exactly what they need. So you can find out by going to, for example, in Seattle, you can go to the Occupy Seattle website and they list the things that they need. Another thing is that there's, I think, a lot of confusion about what this movement is about, and I think people want to be part of the conversation. So again, they can do that. You can invite your friends and neighbors or people in your church or synagogue to go with you to an Occupy site, and you can also have your own conversations about that. We're going to be doing that here in North Kitsap County. We're going to be organizing our own event to bring ourselves into greater understanding of what the issues are and how we feel about it here in North Kitsap County, and the kinds of actions that we may want to take here. For example, Occupy Bremerton is in the process of looking at the possibility of interrupting some of the foreclosures that are happening and the people that are being put out on the streets, and how can we interrupt that process in real time. So in that case, there is no group that's actually camping out, but there is the possibility of occupying the yards of the homes that people are about to lose and say, you know, this is just not okay. We're just not okay with these large banks that received all this taxpayer bailout and are still not working with homeowners to help them stay in their homes.
How do you see the Occupy Wall Street movement developing in the future?
Well, there's a lot of conversation about that now, and especially, you know, with winter rolling in, it's much more difficult to stay outside with the police crackdowns across the country and some of the occupations having been evicted in New York and Oakland and elsewhere. You know, a lot of people are asking that question, what comes next? And I don't think there's any one answer. I think what's really interesting is that there are any number of answers, and they may actually turn out to be more difficult to contain. Some people are occupying buildings. I just heard a report in London about the occupations where they've taken over a building and they're setting up a occupation university where people can come and discuss the question of what kind of an economy they want to build. So people are doing that. Some people are taking the occupations directly to things like the foreclosure hearings and occupying the courtrooms. Here in Washington State, of course, there are actions at the state capitol. I think it's going to be a very interesting time of evolution as people do a combination of more deep thinking about what kind of an economy we want and having those kinds of conversations in various different settings, and also disrupting business as usual to the degree that business as usual is continuing to harm the 99%.
Well, the 15th anniversary issue of Yes Magazine has just come out. Would you like to tell us about your 15th anniversary issue?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you. You know, what we decided is that for this issue, we wanted to celebrate the ordinary people who are making extraordinary things happen but don't necessarily get a lot of attention. So we reached out to our own networks of people, our readers, our contributing editors, and we reached out to some of the more famous people that are part of our community and have written for us. And we asked them to nominate the people that they respect who are doing extraordinary work. And from that list, we winnowed it down to 15 people who are just, each of them is just doing wonderful kinds of leadership in various different communities. So one example is Ai-Jen Poo, who's leading up an organization of domestic workers. And she's starting a campaign called Caring Across Generations. And the notion is that the domestic workers are often the least powerful and the least well-paid in our society, and yet they're the ones that are taking care of our elderly people, our children, our most vulnerable people. So her basic pitch is, you know, wouldn't it be better for everyone if these people were in a good place in their lives, if they were paid well, if they were respected, if they had time off? Wouldn't that both be better for them and be better for the vulnerable people that they're taking care of? So it's a very interesting approach to organizing based on love and compassion and respect for the people at the bottom of the economic ladder, as well as for the people that they care for. Another example is Henry Redcloud, who's a Native American who is building solar and other renewable energy resources on some of the poorest reservations around the country. Another is Tim DeChristopher, who you may know disrupted an attempt to sell oil and gas leases on public land under the Bush administration and is now in prison as a result. He's become quite a hero among young people in the climate movement for his willingness to risk arrest and in this case end up in prison in order to protect pristine public land and also to reduce the amount of fossil fuel going up into the atmosphere. So there's profiles of 15 different people, each of whom is remarkable in their own way, and most of whom are not famous. And I think when people read this, they just have this sense of being inspired because they're just regular people like you and me, and yet they've each chosen in their own way to make a huge difference.
Do you see a connection of these people to the 99% movement?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that kind of leadership, that leadership from below, that quiet, behind-the-scenes work of enabling other people to be powerful, enabling the 99% to be powerful. I think that thread runs throughout this group of people and is very much like the people that we featured in the book who launched the 99% movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement. There's that same form of leadership that is not about one's own ego. It's not about bringing attention to oneself or being the most important. It's a leadership that is about the common good. And I think that's really where big change is happening, because if there is no one person who can draw together the power, and frankly, a lot of us are quite suspicious when any one person gets too powerful. It's just too easy for them to get co-opted. There's too many things that can go wrong, and when power is dispersed and many, many thousands, even millions of people feel that they have that kind of power and they can be part of that process, that's what makes us unstoppable.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think it's that each one of us can be part of this in our own way, that no matter, you know, what our own background is, even if you're part of the 1%, you can be part of this. We have an article on the Yes Magazine website about people who are part of the 1% who are in solidarity with the 99%. So whatever your station in life, the truth is that we need a world that works for everyone, that kind of a society will benefit everyone regardless of where you start from. And that we need to be thinking in terms of how that kind of a world will be able to also sustain our children and our grandchildren. And that brings in the environmental element as well. Naomi Klein makes some excellent points about that, because it's the 1%, the corporate power structure, that's been preventing us from taking action on climate change. And once we start working together as the 99%, we can start saying, you know what? We need a world that we're not going to be flushing down the toilet. We're not going to be overly burdening our atmosphere with climate-changing gases. And we're going to be able to have a stable climate that's going to have sufficient rainfall and sufficient stability so that our children also have the kind of opportunity that we've been having. So whatever your issue is, whatever place you are in your life, there's a place in this movement where you can make a difference. That's what I'd like to leave with your listeners.
Thanks so much for being here, Sarah.
Thank you, Diane.
You have just been listening to Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor of Yes Magazine, and editor, along with the staff of Yes Magazine, of the book This Changes Everything, Occupy Wall Street and the 99% Movement, published in 2011 by Barrett Kohler Publishers. For more information, check on the web at yesmagazine.org. Again, that's yesmagazine.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM. And KEXP.org.